Times. House Speaker John Boehner knew that he would not get any Democratic support for his Plan B when he put it up for a vote last night, but it turned out he couldn't get enough Republican support for his proposal to head off the so-called fiscal cliff. Conservatives refused to support legislation that would hike taxes on those earning more than $1 million. That's a tiny portion of the population. Boehner said it was now up to the president and Harry Reid to avert the fiscal cliff. That's the automatic spending cuts and tax increases scheduled to go into effect in January. Another issue facing Washington and the rest of the country is guns after last Friday's massacre. Vice President Joe Biden had his first meeting yesterday to come up with a set of gun-related proposals. Meanwhile, gun stores are reporting a dramatic increase in sales, and the NRA is holding a press conference this morning. We asked Susan Ferriccio and Jill Lawrence to join us today on Radio Times. Susan Ferriccio is chief congressional correspondent covering both the House and the Senate for the Washington Examiner. And Susan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Also with us, as I said, Jill Lawrence, and she's managing editor of politics at National Journal. And Jill, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Good to be here.
Susan, let me begin with you. How much of an embarrassment is this for House Speaker John Boehner?
Well, he's talking right now to reporters in the Capitol about what happened last night. Basically, I think it just hit a tipping point. I think there was a period where they felt confident they could pass this bill and that thus increase their leverage with the president as they try to come to agreement on a fiscal cliff deal. But he's got a faction of Republicans in his conference that were elected in the Tea Party wave that you might remember from 2010. And for the past 2 years, they've sort of been a bit of a thorn in the side of the GOP leadership because they want to push the party in a direction that's further right than sort of the GOP establishment. And you saw this at play last night where they decided it was not going to be satisfactory to raise tax rates even on people earning $1 million or more. And I think part of the reason is they would like to have sort of a guarantee that there will be substantial cuts in spending in an effort to reduce the nation's debt. There's a sense that this was a big giveaway for them, and it went against their principles for this group of members, 30-odd members. And it was a bigger group, actually, almost 2 years ago, and I think the speaker has reined it in somewhat, which is why they felt hopeful they could pass this. But they are, as we know now, still a pretty strong group. And I think what you saw was sort of, like I said, a tipping point. There was a push from outside groups. If you listen to any radio shows that, you know, say Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levine, who have a great following of the conservative right, pushing against this thing. And I think eventually the influence of all these factors led this group to just pretty much shake their heads at Boehner in this late night meeting last night and say, we're sorry, we are not going to change our minds on that. And Boehner, he's a practical kind of speaker. He didn't sit around and try to twist arms until midnight. He just sort of said, okay, this is the way the caucus, the Republican conference is going to do this, and we are at a stalemate.
Well, Jill, let me get you in on the conversation here. What kind of problems does that create, not just for Speaker Boehner, but even for the Republican Party, if there is majority support among the public for some kind of agreement on this so-called fiscal cliff, and also on these tax issues?
Well, there's overwhelming support in the public for a compromise. And President Obama did win the election with his position on taxes, which I think was the central thing that people knew about him. He wanted tax cuts to expire on people making, well, on income above $250,000 right, for a household. So I don't think there's any question about where the country stands on this. This group that Susan's been talking about in the House, it's more conservative than the Republican establishment, and it's far more conservative than the rest of the country. And there are some people in the House, and there are some conservatives outside the House who have been very upset about the way things are going. In fact, Steve LaTourette, who's leaving the House and who's close to Boehner, said that this is the continuing dumbing down of the party, and he said we're going to be seen more and more as a bunch of extremists that can't even get the majority of our own people to support the policies we're putting forward. So in terms of the Republican brand, which already does very badly in polling, it doesn't seem to be helpful. You know, they're kind of acting like they have not just a seat at the table, but they're at the head of the table and they can dictate the terms, which is not the case.
Well, where does this leave then Speaker Boehner, Susan Ferriccio? And I mean, part of his job is to get votes for legislation. If he can't get votes for his own legislation, where does it leave him?
Well, that's a great question. And I always look at these things over the long haul. I've been on Capitol Hill now for, you know, 20 years. So I've watched the pattern of things from Speaker Foley up till now with Speaker Boehner. And there are times when the Speaker will not be able to get votes on the floor. There was a period where there was lots of success under Majority Leader Tom DeLay, whose nickname was the Hammer. But outside of that, when you have a member who really, really twists arms and is really tough, there are occasions when speakers cannot move things on the floor. It just gets divided too much and they can't move stuff. It happened with Pelosi. It happened with Hastert, certainly, and it'll happen in the future now with Speaker Boehner. The question right now is look at where we are. It's December 21st. The Congress will have to adjourn and then gavel in for the 113th mm-hmm. Congress. When that happens, the House needs to elect a Speaker, and both parties elect a Speaker in the House, and the Speaker needs a majority to win. Now, if he loses, say 30-odd members are unwilling to support him, and they can't get a simple majority to elect him Speaker, there could be a real problem for him if his support collapses in that fashion. So I think there is all kinds of speculation right now about what this might mean for him, because certainly there is a sort of a growing discontent among this very group that blocked the bill last night, and some of them are a little bit upset about the Speaker's decision earlier this month to remove four Republicans from their committee assignments because he didn't feel like they were team players. So there's, again, there's some disgruntled feelings among this very faction that we've been talking about. The question is, will these folks get in the way of John Boehner becoming Speaker in the 113th Congress? And if they do, then what happens?
Well, Jill, let me go back to you, and we were actually talking about this before going on the air. How do people get to go home for Christmas without dealing with these important issues? Many economists say that if January 1st comes around and there hasn't been an agreement, we're not going to necessarily fall off the cliff on that day. But nonetheless, it sets into motion a number of policies that are going to be bad for the economy, even the possibility of the return of a recession.
Well, that's true, but just because everybody goes home, it doesn't necessarily mean there won't be a deal.
Okay.
I mean, in fact, on the National Journal website right now, we have an article by Chris Frates where he quotes Trent Lott as saying the best time to get a deal in Washington is when it's empty.
Oh, interesting. So someone stays behind, or they're just emailing each other?
Well, I'm sure that the president and Harry Reid are talking to each other, and I wouldn't be surprised if the president and John Boehner continue, you know, some kind of private channel conversation. I mean, these people understand their responsibilities, and there may, you know, Boehner's in a very, very tough position. But and I don't know what he's saying as we speak now. But I don't think that anybody's going to want this to happen, or if it does happen, for it to last very long. The other thing may be that, you know, right, and until now you've had a lot of outside pressure from conservative groups like the Club for Growth and Americans for Prosperity, that sort of thing. You may start seeing counter pressure from the business community because, you know, they're all about certainty and they don't like what's going on. And I think we've already seen this morning that the stock market is down. So there may be other pressures coming to bear that will counteract some of this. That's what happened with the TARP bill, if you remember that a while back. In 2008, the fall of 2008, when a hardcore group of Republicans voted against the Troubled Asset Relief Program to bail out the banks, and there was a one-day drop of something like 800 points in the stock market, and the next day or a day later, you know, a day after that, very shortly thereafter, the House passed the law.
But are we talking, Susan, about just kind of political theater? This is how legislation is done in Washington, the kind of sausage making that is often referred to. Is that what we're observing, or is there something else at play here?
Well, I'll tell you what the speaker is saying right now. Somebody asked about what comes next, and
right.
the direct quote from the speaker right a few seconds ago was, "How do we get there? God only knows."
Well, that doesn't ensure confidence.
Mm-hmm. The Dow is down 105, NASDAQ down 34. You know, you see all these things play in together, to answer your question, mm-hmm. and it's outside, and it's outside factors, it's inside factors, all these things working together. But I think the big thing that influences what the outcome will be public reaction to what's going on right now. People don't like this, and that motivates all these members and the president to come together. And I think that's what you're going to see happening, because when the stock market starts dropping, people will see their 401ks take a hit. You see real anger in the public polling. That's when you're going to watch people start to move together. Now, the question here is, and this dovetails with what Boehner just said, there's a logistical problem here that I haven't seen probably ever, which is that if they couldn't get this bill through last night, which was the sort of the high end of a tax agreement with
the $1 million
mark, mm-hmm, they've got to move it with Democrats, right? So say Boehner is willing to put a bill on the floor that is something that would need a majority, would have to pass with Democrats. So it would have a lower threshold for tax increases. The spending cuts would not be so severe. He would still need his own party to help put that to 218, which is the minimum for a simple majority in the House. I'm not sure how he gets there. You know, because
just doing the math.
Because having talked to these guys in recent days, even the most moderate Republicans say they need to see major spending cuts and a guarantee of entitlement reform in the future, or else they feel like they're just giving it all away here and that they're steering the nation toward, you know, economic disaster just because they're not dealing with the spending issues. So they've got to find a formula to get to 218, and that's the part that doesn't seem to have an answer right now.
Yeah, go ahead, Jill. About 45 seconds before our first break, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I heard someone refer to this as political dysfunction on steroids, and I've got to say that in my years of watching it, I think that's true. To get to your point, the underlying problem here is just people who have very strong principles and won't compromise, mm-hmm, even though that is the definition of legislating.
And let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about what's going on in Congress, or I guess more appropriately, what's not going on in Congress. Unable, at least at this point, to come to an agreement on spending and taxes. Talking with Jill Lawrence, a voice you just heard. She's managing editor of politics at the National Journal. Also with us is Susan Ferriccio, and she's chief congressional correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, bigbluemarblebooks.com.
The sound of these voices means Christmas for so many people around the world. The men and boys of the choir of King's College, Cambridge, as they create magic each year with a festival of 9 lessons and carols. I'm Michael Barone. Don't miss our broadcast from England from American Public Media.
Monday morning at 10 on WHYY.
Washington, D.C. quarterback Robert Griffin III is called RG3 by fans. His standout play has some already calling him Rookie of the Year, but one sports commentator gave him a different handle. He called him a cornball brother, not really black. The Barbershop Guys weigh in on just who does get to revoke your black card. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
C
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages, like their sweet and tart hibiscus cranberry juice. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Congress is on its way home and has not been able to come up with some kind of agreement on spending and taxes. I can hardly spit those words out. Talking with Susan Ferriccio and Jill Lawrence, who cover Congress, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jill, let me throw the president into our mix here. Looking at these negotiations, is he the one holding perhaps the better hand here in this negotiation process?
Well, you would think so, since he won re-election pretty definitively. The problem is that there's so much dysfunction that, you know, he's really going to be tested by how long and how he holds out and what he holds out for. I mean, I know liberals who are very upset that he went from $250,000 to $400,000 as the threshold to raise taxes. So, you know, that, and then, of course, there's been a revolt on the left over the change CPI plan, which would, over time, reduce inflation adjustments for Social Security. So, you know, he's got people on his left who are going to be upset by anything he does, and he's got a House that doesn't seem to be open to any kind of compromise, at least the Republicans in it. I think, you know, that if Boehner would resume negotiations with him and they came up with some kind of compromise that was put before the House, Obama could probably get Democrats to vote for it. And then, you know, you'd have to look to the dwindling number of Republican moderates or people who feel some kind of higher responsibility or people who are leaving and don't have anything at stake politically to hope and pray that something would pass. At the moment, I am not sure how they get out of this, and I don't think anyone else is either.
Well, Susan, this is a problem of their own creation, would you say?
It depends how you...
They set this up. They said, you know, here's a timeline. We have to figure out how to make these difficult and important decisions about taxes and spending.
That's right. And the reason is that, I'll tell you, Congress functions in a way, it's an insulated place, and they, in many ways, and these are lawmakers who have a real resistance to doing two things. They have a real resistance to cutting spending, and I'm talking both parties. I know Republicans say they're all for cutting spending, unless it's in their district. And they're also all resistant to raising taxes. Even the Democrats know the political implications of this. And so they're stuck. And these are the two of the hardest issues they ever have to deal with. They never get anywhere. We had various commissions appointed by the president, appointed by the speaker, appointed by the majority leader in the Senate to try to get solutions to how to solve the debt, which is clearly a big problem. I think everyone would agree. We're hitting $17 trillion at some point in the near future. So everyone knows the problem has to be solved, but they go around in circles on this thing, and they have for years, and there just doesn't seem to be an answer. So what do? They do exactly what you just said. They set it up for another deadline, another, you know, thing they put off until the last minute, and we end up doing these kind of cliffs or last-minute fights over raising the debt ceiling, that kind of thing. They happen repeatedly, and it's very clear that the nation has become ultra-fatigued about this kind of thing, and they're fed up with it. And I think the president knows this, and I think the leaders in the House and the Senate know this, too. And that gives me hope that there may be some kind of real solution coming up in the next Congress where they really sit down and try to tackle entitlement reform and just doing something about the growing debt. I think that you're going to see a real effort to just take it on so that this kind of thing stops happening.
Well, but Jill, if people are serious about the debt, it's not going to be dealt with unless spending is looked at, but also taxes are looked at, and taxes are going to have to go up on somebody.
Well, that's true, and I would venture to say they'll go up on everybody one way or another, perhaps more on the wealthy. But, I mean, one of the political considerations here is kind of transcends politics, and that is Obama legacy. I'm sure the president does not want to leave office as the president who put the nation deep in the hole. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, he's going to be very, very committed to doing this. I think he is now. I think possibly there'll be less chance of it happening in the next Congress if Boehner's not the Speaker, because he's now in his second round of very intense negotiations with Obama, where he's shown a willingness to really compromise. In particular, he seems to think now that a 1-to-1 ratio of tax hikes and spending cuts is balanced. Now, you may recall in the presidential campaign when the candidates were asked about this in the debate, all of them raised their hands when asked if they would find a 10-to-1 ratio unacceptable of cuts to.
They didn't like that ratio.
Right. So now we've got a 1-to-1 acceptable to the House Speaker, which probably it reflects his experience in reading the results of an election. So, you know, It's hard to see how this will get better in the next Congress, but there's always brinksmanship. I mean, the last time this happened with the debt ceiling in August of last year, the Senate didn't approve this deal that we're seeing fall apart right now until the same day that the Treasury Department said we would, have to start defaulting on debts. So it's always brinksmanship, but to my mind, this is all very depressing.
Depressing. And I do want to get to our caller, Susan, but if there is not an agreement, do you think everyone will be blamed, or do you think one party blamed over the other, or the White House over Congress, or Congress over the White House? How do you think that will play out?
Well, historically, when bad things happen economically, people look to the leader of the country. And in this situation, I think President Obama is aware of that. I mean, he is the president, and people are going to look to him to say, hey, couldn't you have come up with something that could have passed both chambers and Congress. Just because Republicans, they run the House, but they're not in the White House, they're not in the Senate. And I think that the president is wary of being blamed for this. I know lots of polls show that people seem to think Republicans are to blame, too. I don't know how that'll play out once the actual tax increases and spending cuts happen. I think ultimately everyone will look toward the White House for a solution.
Jill, just picking up on what you said and what Susan said, though, and looking what the president did, starting with $1.6 trillion in taxes and $400 billion in cuts, we're now, from the White House perspective, $1.2 trillion in taxes, $900 billion in cuts. Would it be fair to say that that the president has moved and the Republicans have not, or has there been jockeying on both sides?
Well, the president has moved. The numbers are kind of halfway between what the two sides initially put out, and the Republicans have moved in terms of, well, Boehner has moved in terms of the principle of not raising the top tax rate. So that was a huge, huge thing, you know, saying that they would raise the rate on millionaires, because then you're just talking math. You're not talking principles. So can they split the difference? Well, you know, maybe Obama goes up to, he went from 250 to 400,000. Yeah. Maybe he goes up to 500,000. You know, both sides have given on this. And, you know, in the chained CPI thing, that's a big principle for some Democrats to not, you know, change entitlements structurally in that way that's going to, they say, hurt older people. So both sides have given. And, in fact, a lot of people thought that Boehner and Obama were on a very good track, a pretty fast track to coming up with a deal. And I think if Boehner had been resigned at that point to having Democrats vote for it and as many Republicans as he could get, then they would have continued and we would have had the deal. At this point, you know, still acting as a leader of his party, I don't know where we are.
Mm. So you're saying that he should not have offered Plan B? Or that ended up being, I mean, obviously he didn't get Plan B, and it seems to have hurt the process.
Well, I mean, I think at the beginning everyone thought that Plan B would be sort of pushed in simultaneously with continuing negotiations with the White House, but that's not what happened. It superseded it, and the negotiations stopped, and everyone waited to see what would happen, and now there's been a crack-up.
And that's Jill Lawrence. She's managing editor of politics at National Journal. Also with us, Susan Ferriccio, chief congressional correspondent for the Washington Examiner. We are talking about the negotiations, or in certain cases, lack of negotiations over spending and taxes in Washington. And we do want to talk about some of the gun control or gun issues in Washington as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. This news just in, John Kerry has been nominated to be Secretary of State. Let me get to John from Mayfair to join us on Radio Times. And John, go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
I would like to first start off by saying that I don't blame the President of the United States at all. I fully blame the Republicans. At every point and gesture, I think we have combined multiple issues constantly that are placed on the floor, like we're talking about raising taxes for the most wealthiest and letting the taxes run out and expire. At the same time, we're trying to solve the Medicare issue and Medicaid. Now, we all know that if we would just simply hire people to and employ people to find out where all the waste is in all these agencies, including Social Security, we would find out that the majority of the people, I mean, a lot of people who are on Social Security don't even deserve to even be on it.
Well, John, let me take your point and see what our guests have to say. And he talks about, you know, waste within the system. And Jill, I know that there have been groups and individuals that have looked at waste within the system. Do you think there is enough to help deal with some of our fiscal problems?
Well, the Obama administration has done a real aggressive offensive against Medicare fraud, and they are collecting, I think, billions of dollars. But I don't think you're going to find that it's waste that's driving the debt. And in terms of Social Security, you know, whether people deserve it or not, Social Security is a universal program, so everyone gets it. I mean, there's a debate to be had on whether people who are more affluent should pay more for it or should pay more taxes or should have some kind of means test. But, you know, I think a lot of administrations have gone after waste, fraud, and abuse, and some of them successfully, but it always turns out to be, you know, just a drop in the bucket compared to things like defense spending or, in particular, health costs for Medicare and Medicaid.
Susan, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, well, some of the major drivers of our debt are our entitlements, and certainly what the caller said kind of hits an important point that I think you're going to see more effort to use the reining in of waste, fraud, and abuse to try to raise money. The Republicans passed a bill last night before they pulled the bill on the taxes. They passed a bill that would save money by doing just that, by reining in waste, fraud, and abuse, and by trying to curb some entitlement spending by making sure people who receive the aid are qualified for it. I don't think Social Security was in there, but they were talking like food stamps, et cetera, making sure they're not giving it to people who don't need it. And I know means testing is something we are going to hear more about in the future, as Jill mentioned, which we'll talk about people receiving entitlements later in life when maybe they don't need them. You know, does Warren Buffett really need a Social Security check? Now, he's an extreme example, but there are a lot of people out there that make money and may not necessarily need to collect that Social Security. So we're going to be hearing exactly that, more about means testing and waste, fraud, and abuse. But can that rein in all the spending? No. I mean, one of the things that drives up the costs for federal spending right now is health care and Medicare costs are really growing super rapidly, and I think that's another area that you're going to see people try to really look at to try to control costs.
Let me get, looks like David from Ardmore to join our conversation. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'd like to know, where are the moderate Republicans, particularly in the House? Why is it that the Tea Party Republicans get to dictate policy? And why aren't the moderates standing up to them? I don't get any sense that there's any other faction in the Republican Party except the Tea Party. And your guest said earlier there's only 30 congressmen that identify themselves as Tea Partiers.
David, actually, since you said that, Susan, let me toss that to you, Susan, first, and then to you, Jill.
Yeah, okay, so because of just the way the government works, you need to pass anything, a majority, a simple majority in the House,
Last night that number was 215. I think we had some members missing. So you need a majority, and so you have to look at the Republicans are in control because they have a majority of members over the Democrats. But in order to pass something, you know, a certain percentage of them sometimes don't vote for the bill. And in this case, since 2010, we've had this faction. They don't make up the majority of Republicans, certainly, but they are a big enough faction that they can block legislation, and they operate together to do that sometimes. On the Democratic side, you would sometimes see this with a moderate faction of Democrats who would block Democratic legislation or make things complicated for Nancy Pelosi when she was Speaker. Now on the Republican side, we're seeing it with this Tea Party group. Part of this is due to the fact that in the past several election cycles, we've had what we've called these swing elections where the voters are going one way and then going the other way. And in 2010, they swung right, and we had this Tea Party sort of revolution where a lot of members came in who were further to the right than we've seen. And that's the legacy of that right now is what we saw last night. A lot of those members are still, you know, this is their first term. Many of them are reelected, and they feel empowered, and they are part of the majority in the House. They're not the majority, but they're a big enough faction that they're blocking legislation and influencing the outcome of legislative fights.
Jill, same question to you. Are there moderate Republicans, and if they are, where are they?
Well, there are fewer and fewer. That's part of the problem. The New England example is a good one because they've been shrinking and shrinking from a region which used to send a lot of Republican moderates to Congress. And there are several who are leaving or were defeated as of next year, so it's unclear, you know, that I think their numbers are even going to shrink. Mary Bonham Mack won't be around. Joanne Emerson is taking a new job she's from Missouri. And Steve LaTourette, who's the congressman I quoted before, who's highly critical of this faction, he won't be coming back either. So, I don't think that this is a faction on the ascent. I mean, you could put John Boehner in that group. In his past legislative history, he's worked well with Democrats, and he's been trying on and off to work with President Obama. But, we obviously see that he doesn't have any sway. I mean, I think, you know, these people who were elected in 2010, many of them did not come from legislative backgrounds or even elected office. So they came, they thought they had a mandate to change the way everything worked, but they really had mandates from their districts, which is different than the country. I mean, their districts, a lot of them have been created to be as conservative as possible in order to, by conservative state legislatures. So what they've got, you know, is a very deep, rooted conservatism, which is very broadly and deeply supported by the people that sent them, and that's not a majority. Even this year in the election, even though they continue to hold the House, they lost the national House vote by more than a million votes.
And we're almost up on a break here, Susan, but a brand new CNN poll finding that something like 53% of the American public think the Republican Party is too extreme, and that includes something like 22% of Republicans. Is that a problem for the party going forward?
Well, it's certainly something they pay attention to. I tend to look at groups of polls together to decide, you know, who's getting blamed. So I'd have to look at it. I've seen various polls that seem to pin it on Republicans at this point. One thing I have seen that I think the Republicans can take, some solace in is that a lot of the folks who are being polled are saying that they also agree that spending cuts are really important, that it shouldn't just be tax increases. And Republicans can talk about that more. They can grab onto that and harness that in their effort to try to leverage themselves in this whole fiscal cliff negotiation.
Let's take that another break. We'll get back to our conversation with Susan Ferriccio and Jill Lawrence. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
For many of us, the best part of the holidays is the chance to see old friends or to hear them. For several decades now, Paul Winter has made our holidays brighter with his winter consort and musical guests at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I'm John Schaefer. Join us for the performance, Paul Winter's 32nd Winter Solstice Celebration from NPR Music.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
The new season of HBO's series Enlightened begins in January. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creator and co-star, Mike White. It stars Laura Dern as a corporate executive who, after a public meltdown, goes to a holistic meditative retreat. When she returns to work, she tries and usually fails to keep her sense of inner calm. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Hackers destroy a high-tech man's online life in a matter of minutes. If he can't protect himself, how can others? Also, a doctor makes the case for the reinstatement of the 1994 assault weapons ban. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been spending the last 40 minutes talking about negotiations over the fiscal cliff. Now I do want to shift gears and talk about another issue facing Washington, frankly facing the rest of the country. It's been a week since the Friday massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, where something like 28 people were killed. Vice President Joe Biden tapped by the president to come up with a set of gun-related proposals, had a first meeting. I was reading today that gun stores are reporting a dramatic increase in sales, and the NRA is going to be holding a press conference sometime this morning. We are continuing our conversation with Susan Ferriccio, chief congressional correspondent for the Washington Examiner, and Jill Lawrence, managing editor for politics at National Journal, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jill, do you think there will be some progress or even some agreement on looking at some form of gun legislation?
You know, last week I would have said yes, or even earlier this week, because President Obama seems to have reached the tipping point. I think he will be beside himself if anything like this happens again on his watch, or if it does, and he hasn't done anything to try to stop it. So his speech last week in Newtown, I guess it was this week on Sunday, really signaled to me that he had reached a tipping point. Now, the country seems to be behind him, but again, now we have the House, which I'm not sure is going to ascend to much. There are some conservatives talking about some changes, for instance, limiting high-capacity magazines and maybe even limiting certain types of guns, but I think it's really going to be a test of Joe Biden and others on that task force to come up with some ideas that will be able to pass through the Republican House. I know there are things that the president can do unilaterally, so we'll see if he goes that route.
Susan, just picking up on that, and just to underscore the fact that we're talking about the murder of 20 children, 20 first graders, do you think there's any support for the idea of background checks or closing the gun show loopholes, those kinds of, I think, common sense forms of gun control?
Yeah, I get the sense that, yeah, it's true what Joe was saying. I think it would be real tough to do any kind of gun ban, just because of the House. Mm-hmm. The House Republicans, I don't think they'd move something like that.
But I would say most people are not calling for a gun ban. I mean, certainly the president was not calling for a gun ban, and I don't hear that from the vice president either.
Right. That's true. Well, revising the 1994 assault weapon ban, mm-hmm. I think there definitely has been talk about that. Like, it sunsetted in 2004, and neither party really wanted to tackle bringing it up again because it's so politically poisonous, not just for Republicans, but for many Democrats from pro-gun states who feared it would cost them their jobs if they pushed a bill like that. However, what you just said about the background checks and some other things, I do think that we will see discussion of that and pressure on Republicans to support something like wider, broader background checks, more comprehensive, something to prevent people from getting guns who shouldn't have them, and also the high-volume clips and things that, clearly even many hunters say aren't important. So I think that there is a possibility that gun-related legislation, even if it's not reinstituting the assault weapons ban from 1994, I think it's possible we will see something else come through the House. And, of course, a lot of this will hinge on,
You know, I'm curious to see what the NRA says today.
Mm,
you know, that could play a big role in determining what we do see in the coming Congress. I'm not completely discouraged that nothing will happen at this point. I think that we may see, indeed, something happen in the next Congress on gun control.
Jill, just how powerful is the NRA in Washington?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it has a reputation as a giant, and I think that that's probably not as related to reality as it used to be. And we do see some Democrats edging away from the NRA in states like West Virginia and Virginia, where they have been influential. But there seems to be, you know, particularly with the president and the administration on their side, the gun control side is gathering a little steam at this point. And this whole notion of these 20 funerals for these 20 little children is really making a mark on the national consciousness. So we'll see if the outside game works, if the outside pressure works, because I think that most people would support reinstating the assault weapons ban. The thing that's interesting to me is whether we'll see hunters, who are the bulk of the membership of the NRA, start to make their voices heard. You know, if they took a poll of NRA members, I think it's been shown, actually, that they don't necessarily support this having assault weapons available to everyone, that they don't need this to hunt, and that's the point of it, or for self-protection.
And I should just add that Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania had a change of heart on this issue as well, speaking to the Philadelphia Inquirer earlier this week.
Right. The problem so far is that it's only Democrats who are moving off their positions, and there are conservatives in the Republican Party who are on the outside urging some changes in Republican positions, but it's unclear whether that will happen.
Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Beth from Lehigh Valley joining us on Radio Times. And Beth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I watched The Moment of Silence this morning on TV. And as a teacher, a mother, and a person who grew up in a family of hunters, although I personally don't own a gun or shoot anything, I just got done calling Senators Casey and my other representatives, Dent and Toomey, and I said to them exactly this. I would hope that they would have enough courage in standing up to NRA pressure to do the right thing and have as much courage as those teacher angels did in protecting those babies. I mean, if they can stand there in the line of fire directly, can our representatives stand there and protect us? That's what I want to know. I don't think there's any need. I know there's no need for an assault weapon, military grade, in civilian life. There's nothing you can use it for that has any purpose. We don't need them, and our freedoms are not infringed upon by taking them away. It just, I want them to do what they should do, and I want them to be courageous.
Well, Beth, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and one can certainly hear the emotion in her voice as well. And Susan, just, I guess, to underscore the fact, because it's been a week since the Rampage shooting, just the horror of what happened in that school in Newtown, Connecticut.
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, I think what I sense just from listening to callers and reading articles, people just want to do something to make this not happen again. And I think as this moves along, this discussion about gun control, you're going to hear a lot of talk about other factors too, like what do we do about the mentally ill? Are there enough resources to really help parents who have young adult children who are in that kind of gray area where what do they do when they're having trouble? And then we're going to hear talk about school safety. How can we keep someone from busting in and causing tragic destruction? You know, there's going to be all kinds of talk about that, and you're also going to hear people say, and people aren't going to like to hear this, that gun control would not have stopped what happened last week for a variety of reasons, one of them being that it would not include the guns that are already out there, and which could take 100 years before those are no longer, you know, a threat. And so there's going to be all kinds of talk about what's the best way to make this stop, and you're going to hear all kinds of discussion, which is great, because maybe, you know, there's can be a multifaceted solution to this that will really keep everybody safer.
And just one more comment about that, then we'll get back to our callers. Jill, I'm also wondering how law enforcement is going to deal with this issue as well. I should say that the Philadelphia Police Commissioner, part of the group tapped by Vice President Joe Biden to come up with some kind of proposal, but it seems like they have an important voice.
Well, they do, and they don't like these guns on the street. And it's true that any reinstatement of the assault weapons ban wouldn't be able to confiscate the 200 to 300 million that are already out there, or however many are out there. But there are ways. I think Australia has succeeded with buyback programs where you can get millions of them, tens of millions of them, off the street, which is a start. And I think that there is a deeper problem, which is ideology. I mean, some of these people who really support this are not enthralled to the NRA. They simply believe that this is a huge issue. You know, it's a constitutional issue. It's a constitutional right. And you know, until people don't see it that way, some of them are going to be immovable. Mm-hmm. One of the people who really notably moved off of that was Joe Scarborough, who used to be in Congress, and he said when he was in Congress, he saw it as a symbolic issue, you know, a symbolic sign of, you know, how committed you were to the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. And reality, he said, has trumped that. Murder has trumped that. But he's not in Congress any longer. So we'll see if anyone else follows his lead.
I'm looking at something that Justice Scalia said when the court ruled most recently on guns, and he says, like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited, and went on to underscore that. Susan, this is a conservative justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, and that's going to be part of the big debate here. And that's where I think you might see some movement, where people say, okay, you know, the Second Amendment, the right to own a gun, but what does that really mean? Does that mean you should be able to own the kind of gun that can take out an elementary school? How far does that right go? What is that right? And you're going to hear a lot of talk about that, I think, when the new Congress resumes and this thing gets on the table, because there will be legislation, because they'll put it up in the Senate for mm-hmm. sure. You know, Dianne Feinstein has already said that she would put a measure forward that would limit guns, and I think that it's going to be in part of the discussion. You're going to hear what Biden's group comes up with. This is going to be a really interesting discussion. I think that what Jill was saying before about the NRA members, that could play a really big role in this, because you know, if they are talking about, you know, not needing assault weapons or not needing these high volume magazine clips, that could really sway things. When there's big change in Congress on certain things, say immigration, health care reform, gun control, it moves along like a glacier, kind of. But if it's moving, it can pick up momentum. And I think that's what you might see here. You're seeing a little bit of movement, even though it was just the Democrats talking last week, like Manchin and some others who normally would never say anything about gun control. Just the fact that they are moving a little bit suggests that this whole thing could be heading in another direction. That's usually how it goes in Congress. And so I think we might be seeing some change ahead. It may not be major, but it's major for Congress.
I just got this word. It looks like the NRA press conference is going to begin at around 11 o'clock. Let me shift gears here, Jill, and actually toss something to you. Talking about the president, he won re-election. Second terms sometimes are fraught with problems. We know when President Bush won re-election, he talked about a mandate. He was not able to make much progress on immigration and got a lot of pushback on his changes to Social Security. Do you think the president has a mandate?
Not really. I don't think anyone has a mandate these days. I think that the president hit it on the nose in the interview he thought was off the record right before the election with the Des Moines Register editorial board. You know, Republicans may find it in their self-interest to come to some kind of agreement on immigration. You know, again, I think there's going to be the schism between the establishment and the Tea Party Republicans in the House. But the future of the party could depend on them just neutralizing this issue and coming up with some way of dealing with 11 million people in the country illegally. Mm. I don't think that's going to solve all their political problems, but it certainly would be a start. And the sooner they do it, you know, the faster it'll be in the rearview mirror and they can move on. So I think, you know, it's possible that he will have some kind of success on immigration reform. I don't think we're going to see the kind of scandals that we saw. Maybe I'll grow to regret that statement, but, you know, like a Clinton or a Reagan with Iran-Contra or Monica Lewinsky, it doesn't seem like that's the type of thing that's going to happen. So, you know, maybe there will be some constructive legislation. But the other thing that's a big if is what happens in the 2014 midterms. You know, do Democrats make gains? Do they lose what ground they've gained this year? You know, that'll show a signal of where the country wants, everyone wants us to go.
Well, Susan, we have about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. What are you looking for when you look at 2013 and beyond?
I think all of this will hinge back on what we started on today, which is the fiscal cliff, because it's going to push into the new year, because there will be a requirement that they address entitlements, I'm almost certain, and tax reform. I think that's going to dominate the next Congress and be really a part of Obama's legacy as president, because no president has been able to tackle this. And he is the one who it has fallen upon to deal with it right now. And how he does it, what the outcome is, will really play a big role in what his legacy is ultimately.
Well, we have to end our discussion. Susan Ferriccio, Jill Lawrence, thank you for joining us. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe-Wang. We are closing things out with the Norristown-born organist Jimmy Smith's 1964 version of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. Sounded so good. Jimmy Smith's 1964 version of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. Coming up next.